You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
Trump, that he would actually implement things like the deportations of millions of people. I think that sort of gives you some insight into what people, at least in the Latino community and communities of color, see as being the stakes during this election, or the danger in this election.
That's the voice of author and activist David Bacon. On this week's show, we speak to David Bacon about the upcoming U.S. elections and the important choice Americans have to make. So stay tuned.
My guest this morning is David Bacon. David Bacon is a long-time hard-led activist who has written several books on the plight of migrant workers in the U.S. His latest book is In the Fields of the North, coming up soon. Very privileged to have you on our show, David. Thank you for joining us.
I'm glad to be with you, Sylvia, as always.
Now, we are facing a U.S. election. For many people, the U.S. president is the most powerful person in the world, given the power that the U.S. Army and economic influence in the world has. What should we be paying attention to?
You know, we have, for the Democratic Party, we have Hillary Clinton. Hillary Clinton, well, she was the former Secretary of State under Obama, and I think that kind of gives you some insight into what her politics are. They kind of reflect the center of the Democratic Party. So in terms of foreign policy, she's very interventionist and basically not a particular friend of progressive movements in other countries, as witnessed, for instance, in Honduras, where she was responsible for the Obama administration's recognizing the coup government in Honduras, despite the illegality of the way that Zelaya had been deposed. And then, you know, sort of said that she was surprised by the flow of migrants out of Honduras to the United States, in great part as a result of that. You know, domestically, Hillary Clinton is kind of a mixed bag, I guess I would say, in the sense that popular pressure, for instance, especially from unions, from communities, working class communities, especially communities of color, have forced her, for instance, to take positions against free trade agreements that she formerly had supported, in which the Democratic Party had formerly supported, the chief among them being, of course, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which she now says that she will oppose. But, you know, the Democratic Party is basically a party that supports free trade policies. That's not to say that there aren't people in Congress from the Democrats who are opposed to it. In fact, there are quite a lot. But Clinton historically was not one of them. And then when the presidential campaign began, she became, you know, more explicitly opposed to the TPP. I think that also one of the things that you can say about Hillary Clinton in her favor is that she has recognized the police killings in the U.S., which have given rise to the Black Lives Matter movement, and has begun to speak out for racial justice in the U.S. And again, I guess you could say that this is also in response to public pressure, but she's done it in the context of a presidential campaign in which racism has become, if not the defining issue, one of the most important issues between her and her opponent, who of course is Donald Trump. You know, Donald Trump is a billionaire real estate investor, somebody who has really sat outside the formal structure of the Republican Party and then ran a campaign to get the Republican nomination, basically using a combination of very overt racist hysteria, calling Mexicans, for instance, robbers and rapists, and basically trying to whip up racist hysteria as a way of discrediting his opponents and, you know, basically appealing for the votes of a very conservative section, the sort of Tea Party section of the Republican Party. That was successful. It got him the nomination. He combined that with a criticism of free trade agreements and free trade policies. Now, you could say this is extreme hypocrisy, which of course it is, because, you know, Donald Trump never had anything to say about free trade agreements until this campaign began. And he tried to adopt the same attitude that was taken by people like Ross Perot in the era of NAFTA, saying that, you know, the free trade agreements were selling out workers in the United States, and that the enemy of workers in the United States were Mexican workers who were going to get those jobs and work for cheap. So in a way, his opposition even to free trade agreements had this very kind of racist tinge to it. You know, he has gotten a lot of money for his campaign. First of all, he's a very wealthy man himself. And then some of the Republican funders under the table have been giving him money, even though the structure of the Republican Party has been very divided about his candidacy. So, you know, those are the two main candidates. You know, for a while it looked like Hillary Clinton pretty much had a lock on the election. It doesn't seem that way anymore. It seems that pretty much anything could happen next Tuesday.
I want to focus a little bit on this, both the international policy and the domestic policies that each candidate represents. So let's begin first with the international, because for us in Latin America, NAFTA was a huge blow to the economic well-being of countries like Mexico and throughout Latin America. Has had a great impact, particularly where it imposes new jurisdiction, you know, where our country's laws seem to be no longer valid. Can we talk a little bit about that? You mentioned in your book, No One's Illegal, the impact that this has had on the white migration and the way that immigrants were then, you know, treated in the U.S. as they arrived.
Sure. Well, I think the first thing to say about it, Sylvia, is that NAFTA, the TPP, the Free Trade Area of the Americas, which never passed, you know, the trade agreement with Colombia, these are all kind of legal expressions of a global economic system that is much larger than individual trade agreements. What we're really looking at here and what we're talking is how imperialism operates in the 21st century. So the penetration of the economies of Latin American countries like Mexico, for instance, or Colombia, this is not something that started with the trade agreements. It's been going on for, well, two centuries at least. So the trade agreements, in many ways, what they are doing is they are codifying, first of all, what already exists on the ground, and secondly, they are creating openings for new waves of investment from the U.S., and including from Canada and Latin America, and also making it much more difficult for the people of Latin American countries to protect themselves from the consequences of that investment. And one of the chief consequences of that investment is the displacement of people. Because when U.S. grain companies dump corn, for instance, in Mexico, and make it very, very difficult for corn farmers to survive in, you know, states like Oaxaca, then people are displaced and they have to begin migrating in search of their survival. The same thing happens when Canadian mining companies come into Oaxaca and then develop mines, which also, you know, have the same displacing kind of result. And so we get these waves of people basically looking for survival, both migrating within Mexico and Latin America itself, know, those are the workers who become the workforce, for instance, in the maquiladoras on the U.S.-Mexico border, but then also begin crossing borders and looking for work in the U.S. and Canada, in the north. And again, this is also, it's important to say, this is also not just a question of the U.S. and Canada on one hand and Latin America on the other. This is a global process. And we are looking, for instance, at the way in which this process is playing out with such brutal results in Europe, where literally thousands of people are drowning in the Mediterranean every year as they seek to come to Europe as a result of having been displaced, especially in Africa. So, again, you know, this is sort of the worldwide system and how it operates and what its consequences are. So, again, you know, we have these agreements then that get proposed by large corporations who are kind of running the system and to basically codify what exists and open up new opportunities. So the North American Free Trade Agreement was a very, very important one and certainly had the those effects. Now, because these are kind of the policies of capital, I guess you would say, they are bipartisan policies. You know, they're not ones in which there is a basic disagreement between, in the U.S., the Republican and Democratic Party. Now, that's not to say that there aren't sometimes disagreements over the particular provisions of individual agreements, or, as is the case right now, over whether it's politically wise, for instance, for either one of these parties to be insisting on this agreement at a time when public opinion in the United States is very much opposed to them. But, you know, the North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, was negotiated by a Republican president, George Bush Sr., and it was forced through Congress by a Democratic president, Bill Clinton, with primarily the votes of Republican Congress members. So, you know, that just sort of shows you what the kind of bipartisan nature of these policies are. The reason why both Trump and Clinton, Hillary Clinton, are opposing the TPP now in the United States does not have much to do with their rejection of this kind of free trade economic world order. What it really has to do with is the fact that both of them are recognizing that because of the kind of economic pressure that they have put on workers in the United States, these agreements are very unpopular. And so to go into a presidential election and to say that you're supporting this agreement would be kind of like the kiss of death. So that means that, you know, they're saying right now that they're opposing them. Does that mean that Clinton or Trump would refuse to sign those agreements, or the TPP in particular, or the TPIP, the one that's being negotiated with Europe, once they become president? I don't think so. You know, I mean, perhaps there would be some renegotiation of some of the provisions of them, but to depend on these kind of pre-election promises as an indication that they have become opposed to free trade agreements and opposed to this kind of economic policy, that's not happening. Voters in the United States have to look past the rhetoric of either one of these candidates to see what the reality is, who they really are. You know, in Trump's case, you know, Trump is one of the wealthiest people in New York City, a city of enormous wealth. To think that he is going to kind of go against the interests of corporations and the wealthy in the United States and begin, you know, vetoing trade agreements if he were to become president, I think would be a very, very naive thing to make, or a very naive judgment to make. So that's kind of it as far as the trade agreements go. Again, also there are two other candidates of minor parties in the U.S. presidential race, Jill Stein from the Green Party and Gary Johnson from the Libertarians. The Libertarians are kind of ultimately a very conservative party, an anti-worker and anti-labor party. But they do oppose trade agreements because they oppose government regulation, period, the end. Jill Stein is a much more progressive candidate, and her opposition to trade agreements, I think, is, first of all, is very real, and it's also based on exactly the kind of economic consequences that we've been talking about here. But neither one of those two candidates, the U.S. political system locks out third parties, so neither one of those two parties have any chance of becoming a major force in the presidential election itself.
I want to pick up on something you said. And speaking of trade agreements, you said this is a way to codify how imperialism operates in the 21st century. I think that is a beautiful articulation, because in many ways, whether I am reading your book, The Right to Stay, or, No One's Illegal, or I'm imagining in your latest book, In the Fields of the North, there is a correlation, and it's the struggle of workers to become visible in an imperialist system. We're not, we're not even part of the equation. We don't have minimum wages, the minimum wage is like this odious and reprehensible wage that doesn't even allow people to be able to sustain themselves. So how do we engage in this election in a way that could be productive, that could lead to some coalitions that may enable us to recover some of the gains that were won, right, by through great battles, for workers' rights, against racism, against, the terrible xenophobia that divides us in a world that is oppressed by an imperialist system that, disregards human life?
Well, I think that the candidacy of Bernie Sanders, when he was running for the Democratic Party nomination, shows us a lot of possibilities in terms of how working people can organize themselves and can participate in elections in the United States. He, first of all, was able to finance his campaign, and that means raising millions of dollars through the aggregating the small contributions of millions of people. In other words, he did not depend on getting the money of corporations or wealthy people in order to finance a campaign. That's very important, because what it really says is that working people do have the ability to raise enough money to be able to compete in the U.S. electoral process, that we are not necessarily locked out by these extremely, first of all, unfair rules that govern, corporate contributions, where the Supreme Court has decided that corporations can contribute however much money they want because this is a form of free speech. It's a ridiculous decision. But nevertheless, I think that Sanders, first of all, showed that, we have resources of our own as working people. Secondly, I think he showed that working people as an organized political force can change the political debate. Hillary Clinton, for instance, I don't think would have ever come out against the Trans-Pacific Partnership had it not been for the Sanders candidacy and the way in which he talked about the impact of free trade on working people in a way that was very, very not only different from, but the opposite of what Donald Trump was saying. In other words, Sanders said that that it's true that the North American Free Trade Agreement and other trade agreements like the TPP were causing massive dislocation and unemployment in the United States and putting enormous pressure on workers and unions, and that the answer to that was to change this kind of economic system, get rid of the political power of the banks, and not to look at other workers, especially in Mexico, or immigrants as being the enemy of other workers here. That was a very important and a kind of anti-racist contribution that Sanders made to that campaign. So I think that a lot of people in the U.S. on the left have been looking at that campaign and really thinking, what does this mean for the future? Now, our political structure, especially in elections, is so distorted that it was possible for those people that control the Democratic Party and those economic and political forces that control the Democratic Party to prevent, in the end, Sanders from becoming the nominee, although he came pretty damn close. But, you know, so I think that obviously there's still a long struggle to be waged here, but I think that what he showed is that, as you say, si se puede, that it is possible for us to wage the struggle as working people. Now, though, we have to figure out what to do on election day, which is a week from today. And I think that on the left, you know, there are definitely divisions of opinion. There are some people who feel that the Democratic Party and the way that they treated Sanders exposed itself as being still in the end a corporate-run party and therefore won't vote for its candidate, Hillary Clinton, and they are supporting Jill Stein in the Green Party. But I think on the left, most people, especially organizations and communities of color and unions, have come to the conclusion that essentially that the danger of Donald Trump being elected president and the racism and the extreme right-wing policies that he has advocated and talked about is so great that in the end, people are going to have to vote for Clinton as a way of keeping him from becoming president. So that's kind of the situation that the left finds itself in here. And you could say, well, this has been the same situation the left has found itself in election after election. But I think that the Sanders candidacy really showed that it is possible for us to change that system, but it's obviously going to take a lot more organization and work to do that.
How do we create a counter-narrative that unites us, that co-creates a society where everyone has dignity and possibilities to create a good life for themselves?
Well, you know, Sylvia, I was recently in Nebraska and had a chance to talk with people, you know, first of all, a very old friend of mine, Sergio Sosa, who was a participant in the guerrilla in the war in Guatemala, and then came to the U.S., where he has become a political activist and organizer for many years, and now heads a project called the Heartland Workers Center in Omaha, and this center is now, on the one hand, has been for a long time, helping immigrant Mexican and Guatemalan workers, especially in meatpacking plants, and Nebraska is a meatpacking state, to organize themselves into unions, to organize within unions, to democratize the unions that they belong to, but also, especially now, organizing politically in communities where Latinos are becoming a larger and larger percentage of the population, and also a population that is beginning to kind of flex its political muscles or look for political power. In Omaha itself, about 20% of the people who live in Omaha, which is the largest city in Nebraska, are Latinos. Another about similar percentage are African American. So those two communities, together with progressive white people, have the potential at some point of becoming a political coalition that can take power in Omaha. And Omaha is probably the most corporate-controlled city in the United States. So, first of all, changing demographics and the organization of people is kind of the route that people are taking to political power there. In addition, in the small towns in Nebraska where the meatpacking industry has relocated, most of the big meatpacking plants that basically produce the pork and beef and chicken for people's dinner tables all across the country. In these towns, Latinos have become, in some cases, the majority of the population. So again, this creates the potential for people winning some political power on a local level. And the obstacles that people have faced, well, first of all, historically, people have come as immigrants, meaning that they were not citizens. So in the United States, if you're not a citizen, you can't vote. So over time, people have, at least many people have gained legal resident status, have gone on to become citizens. They've also had families, they've had children, those children are growing up. They are citizens. So what this means is that in many small towns, people are beginning to realize that they have the ability to elect people to office and to achieve some kind of political power. Now, Nebraska is one of the most Republican states in the United States. So this kind of demographic shift and the organization of people, especially organization of people around progressive demands, has the potential for really shifting that political complexion of the state. So clearly what this means is that people have to get organized on a grassroots level. Also, that the questions in the United States around immigration status, the ability of undocumented people to gain legal status, the ability of people with legal status to become citizens and gain the right to vote, this has enormous political consequences and can create the possibility of gaining political power over a period of time. So it's not just that you can kind of sit back and wait for changing demographics to sort of take its course and it's automatically going to lead to a shift in political power. You know, people have to be organized and people have to look out for the possibility of creating political coalitions between Latinos and African Americans and unions and progressive white people. But these possibilities do exist, and I think this is where political change in the United States is going to come from. In this election, one of the interesting things to see was that people in the Latino community in Omaha and in these small towns in Nebraska were very, very, very worried about Donald Trump, and particularly because of Trump's repeated threats that if he is elected president, he is going to deport all the undocumented people in the United States. And that would have a devastating impact on communities in Nebraska. So, you know, there is a big wave of people trying to, those people who have become citizens. You know, I was sat in the living room of a man who had become a citizen 16 years ago and had never registered to vote before and decided to register to vote in this election because of the threat of the deportations. I don't think that it's because people have fallen in love with Hillary Clinton. I think it's because people recognize the danger of the racism and it's not just racism as an attitude or racism as sort of insulting remarks, but these proposals from Trump that he would actually implement things like the deportations of billions of people. I think that sort of gives you some insight into what people, at least in the Latino community and communities of color, see as being the stakes during this election or the danger in this election.
Thank you so much for being with us. My guest is David Bacon. He is the author of In the Fields of the North, coming up soon, and his latest book, The Right to Stay Home. Thank you again for joining us.
Thank you, Sylvia.
Take care.
We've come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is an internationally syndicated weekly program made available through campus and community stations and available out to the world at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Visit Latin Waves Media to hear previous shows, to access resources, or support our efforts towards social change via community project engagement. Thank you, and bye for now.